Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Frank Moss, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Passport Services at the Department of State. Also joining us in our conversation is Bonnie Glick. Frank, during the last fiscal year, the State Department processed a record 8.8 million U.S. passports, and you're predicting that you'll process about 10 million this year. What factors have contributed to this growth in processing?
Well, I think there are three or four at work. One is that clearly Americans are acquiring passports not just as travel documents but also as portable proof of identity and nationality. I think that's especially true, by the way, for some of our recently naturalized citizens. They may want to go back to their home country, but they also want something they can have with them to prove they're an American citizen. Second point that is out there is certainly that there is continuing increases in the demand for international travel, particularly Latin America and the Caribbean. Any of us who have been on an airplane recently flying across the Atlantic or Pacific, I think, can attest to how crowded aircraft are. Another issue that is out there as well is that we have this Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative coming, which will require more formal documentation, not necessarily a passport. We're looking at some alternatives there, but certainly more formal documentation to help American citizens establish their identity and nationality when they return to the United States. So these factors, as well as clearly just natural population growth, are raising the demand for passport services. It's also worth noting, however, that even though we are issuing 10 million passports this year, the percentage of Americans having a passport is really rather low. It's probably about 24% of the number of American citizens in this country. That passport penetration rate, if you will, is increasing rather significantly, but still it is much lower than even what is found in Canada, let alone the rates found in Western Europe.
Do you foresee the passport ever becoming the primary form of identification other than a driver's license?
I could see that happening in some areas of the country, particularly near the land borders where people routinely go back and forth to Canada or Mexico. I don't see that as being nearly the same, for example, someone living in middle America, if you will. And obviously, that's not our mission. Our mission is to facilitate the movement of persons across our international borders. Possible, yes. Probable, I would probably say no.
How is your office protecting the integrity and security of the U.S. passport, and what kind of screening steps are being taken during the processing?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that really reflects well on the state of interagency or within the U.S. government data sharing. Because at the end of the day, what we have to depend upon is data from other agencies, the law enforcement community, the intelligence community, to help us identify persons to whom passport issuance could be a risk. Let me give you one example. We have about 4 million people whose names are in our passport lookout system. We have very sophisticated search engines to help ensure that the applicant we can match up, if the case may be, to a name in that database. One of the largest groups of those names, for example, are deadbeat moms and dads. It's about 3 million people in the United States who, by law, cannot get a passport because they're more than $5,000 in arrears on child support. And the concern there clearly is they would get the passport in order to flee their child support requirements. There are other couple hundred thousand names in there as well from the law enforcement community, others from the intelligence community, but they make up a holistic group that we look at to really make sure that we're only giving passports to people who are entitled to them. And what we're also doing more and more is evolving from a system in which data was pushed to us by other agencies to one in which we are pulling the data to us. We've had recent success with negotiating agreements with the Terrorism Screening Center, the TSC, as well as the FBI, to help close off and make the holes, in this case being physical holes, in our system a little bit smaller. And I think we're doing a good job at ensuring the integrity. The last point I would say is we do a lot of training of our passport adjudicators, a lot of lessons learned, as well as after-the-fact audits, surprise audits, where basically a red team comes into an agency, looks at 1,000, 1,200, 1,400 recently issued passport applications just to see what we can find out. What are people missing? What do they need to be retrained on? So working together, all of these steps are ones we use to ensure the integrity of the system.
You mentioned some federal agencies. Are there any non-federal agencies, say, at a state or provincial level by which you have to partner with in order to ensure the integrity of the passports?
Well, it's not a direct partnership, but clearly one of the basic documents we depend upon is the birth certificates. So we're very interested in how county, states, local governments, what have you, make those available over the web or don't make them available, what requirements they impose in order to ensure that only the person who is truly entitled to the birth certificate gets it. And then, of course, there's also the issue of driver's licenses. I have staff who are working with the Department of Homeland Security on the Real ID Bill and other staff who are working with the vital statistics community around the United States on improvements to the birth certificate process. And then on the federal level, of course, we also have work on naturalization certificates, naturalization process, with our partners in DHS. And the other point I would say is we also, in some respects, depend upon the private sector as well. We do have cases in which, as part of our fraud investigations, we do depend upon information from private sector databases to help ensure whether the person is who they claim to be in the passport application process. Not widespread, but it's a tool that we do find real value to in terms of anti-fraud work.
Frank, turning to the passport book itself, I understand that the passport has physically undergone some changes. How is the current passport different from the older version, and why were these changes needed?
I'd like to say that we at Passport Services are committed to the concept of basically continuous product improvement, and right now we're really at the cusp of that effort. Passports for years have been essentially a paper-based book-type document. We can all remember getting the stamps in them, entry stamps, exit cachets, what have you. What we're now evolving to is a document that really is bringing it into the information age. We have a several-faceted effort underway to improve the U.S. passport. First, we have redesigned the passport literally from cover to cover. New artwork, new security features, literally new paper, new inks, new systems to protect the data that we write to the data page of the passport. We've even moved the data page of the passport, changed passport book numbering systems, all as part of efforts to improve the security of the book. The second thing we have is the introduction of biometrics into the U.S. passport. Now, I want to assure everyone the only biometric we'll be using in the first generation is the facial image of the traveler. The same image that you see on the data page of your passport will be written electronically to a chip that will be embedded in the rear cover of that passport, along with associated biographical data, your name, your date of birth, the passport issuance date, expiry date, things of this nature. And that really will help ensure that only the person to whom the passport was issued can use that as a travel document. And as well, we are also combining these improvements to the physical side and the biometric side, as I said earlier, with strengthening the adjudication process. I like to think of it as almost a triangular effort to improve all aspects of the process, because we know if we make one area of the book stronger and yet do not make comparable improvements to other aspects of our system, we run the real risk of creating a vulnerability that those who wish to abuse or attack our system will try and take advantage of.
This is, I think, what you're calling the U.S. electronic passport or e-passport. Is that correct?
That's correct. The e-passport process has been underway at the State Department for a number of years. We're very close now to actually awarding the single largest contract, which will be for chip procurement of these chips and book covers that the government printing office will then assemble into, if you will, raw passports. Our timeline shows this as being in production of our first diplomatic and official passports. Yes, my colleagues and I will be the guinea pigs on this one, beginning in December of this year. And then late next January or early February of 2006, we expect to begin producing tourist passports and then to complete the entire transition of our system from a paper-based document to one including embedded biometrics by October 2006.
And going forward, what type of biometric capabilities do you plan on including in the e-passports?
Very good question, Bonnie. What we'll be doing in the first generation is really making an electronic copy of the photograph and the data that is on the data page of the passport. This is the international community's baseline standard. Now, I have to tell everyone that we're clearly buying a chip with a storage capacity of 64 kilobytes, and that is considerably more than we need to just write the photograph and the biographical data there. So we're future-proofing our process. We're already looking at additional biometrics. We're looking at fusion biometrics, that is a photographic image with another biometric. We're looking at iris scans. We're looking at finger scans. We're looking at the possibility of multiple photographs being written to the chip, because the more images you have, the more accurate it makes facial recognition matching. So we haven't really decided on what generation 2 or 3 will be, but we are working on generation 1, which will be an electronic copy of what's on the data page of the passport.
It sounds like there could be potentially a lot of information on these chips as you move forward through subsequent generations. How would security and privacy issues with the e-passports be addressed?
Again, another very good question. We've taken a lot of criticism from the privacy community. It really has forced us to go back and take another look at our approach. And I think that the result of it is we've come up with a more secure U.S. passport. We'll be incorporating several technologies to help secure the data on the chip. First of all, the cover of the passport will have a metallic material embedded in the cover to help prevent unauthorized reading as long as the passport is closed or mostly closed. Secondly, we'll be using a technology called basic access control to ensure that the passport data can only be read after what we call the machine-readable zone. Those two lines of data that are typed at the bottom of your data page of a passport are read electronically, generate an electronic key that then allows the data to be read. Third, basic access control also provides a means to encrypt the communication between the chip and the reader so the data is not going in the clear. And then last, we depend upon public key infrastructure technology to verify the authenticity of the data. Once that data is written to the chip, it is locked down. Literally, physical connections are destroyed, and then the PKI calculations help to ensure that not a single bit of that data is manipulated or changed. If it does, it throws off the PKI calculations, and basically the proverbial red light goes on. So we think that all these steps together are making a much more secure passport. And our final commitment is we will only go into production of this passport when we're confident that we have addressed all the security concerns that have been brought up to us to the maximum extent possible. We think we're there, and we continue to talk to the privacy community. And just recently, we've actually had privacy experts tell us that, you know, we think you've pretty well got this one wired. So we remain very confident of the technological approaches we're taking.
What is the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative and how is it supporting safe travel? We will ask State Deputy Assistant Secretary Frank Moss to explain this to us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.